News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Ayo Yabake. And this week, Mike, you and I talk about Summitry, because you know we can't resist a good summit. And this week we have two.
And as if the prospects for concrete global climate action weren't depressing enough, we'll also check in on Facebook going meta, Alec Baldwin shooting people, and Joe Manchin's coal brokerage.
Yeah, there's some good stuff like hidden in this episode. But generally speaking, there's a little bit of skepticism about what's going on in the world.
You know, the news is macabre, appropriate for Halloween.
agreed. All right, shall we get into it?
Let's get into it. Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike. It's good to see you on a
Great
Tuesday
to see
night.
You. You're looking well tonight.
I have to say, you're looking well tonight, too. You're wearing plaid because it's the fall officially. It's like supposed to get down to 39 tonight. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did. It's been like November just really has come in like a wrecking ball.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't notice, by the way, for listeners, I should describe Mike's outfit more fully. It's actually a Henley underneath a plaid, like New England shirt.
So the Henley under the flannel is...
It's very Dartmouth. It's very Dartmouth.
It's a go-to for sure. Here's what happened. Last week, we did this and we've started putting out video clips for those who follow News and Brews Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And you were wearing like a tie and a really nice sweater. You got a nice sweater on again today. I can't tell if you're wearing a tie or not.
I'm not wearing a tie.
Okay. So you've stepped it down. I was wearing a like schlubby t-shirt and had to like scramble right before the recording to throw on a flannel over top of it so that I wouldn't look just like, you know, the guy like crashing your podcast on our video.
But it's your role. You're like the schlubby.
It's true.
You're the schlubby one. And I'm like, you know, an 80-year-old man called and they want their clothes back.
we'll go back to the bow tie next week.
Yeah, I'm totally, you know, I'm always into rocking a bow tie. But yeah, it's great to see you. Are you actually enjoying a brew on News and Brews night?
I am. We'll get to that in a minute. I think we first need to do a little Halloween recap, though. How was your Halloween?
So I'm not a huge Halloween fan. Like, let me just start with that. This is not something that I ever like was into. I like to wear my little V-neck sweaters and just call it a day. And so I was never really, even as a kid, I think I was never really into it.
Little Errol rolling around in his bow tie.
Yeah, or something. Oh, I'm a cowboy or something. I had some go-to, you know, costume, I'm sure that I did to appease my parents and other people. And now I'm super into it because I have kids. By super into it, I mean we recycle costumes between the older one and the younger one. Let's be real. My youngest wore the giraffe costume, which has a like tutu with a tail on it, which is like
strong.
Insanely cute.
Really strong.
And then my older one wanted to be a rainbow robot. And so we said yes. And so she was a rainbow robot.
Excellent.
It was an amazing evening. Like I think Isla, my oldest, I think we said on a scale of 0 to infinity, how awesome was Halloween? And she goes, infinity.
Nice.
It was great.
So first of all, I don't think there is any other day of the year that draws a clearer line between your 20s and your 30s than Halloween.
I believe that.
And it's like way more awesome to do it with kids. Like just everything.
What about your almost 40s? Does that count?
That's your 30s.
Okay.
Here's what I think it is. It's like, there's like the spookiness. It's sort of like you're exposed to things that are scary. And immediately followed up with like whimsy and candy and friends and meeting neighbors. It's just like sort of the juxtaposition of like, there are scary things out there, but your life is all these wonderful things.
Yeah.
That I think is magical.
Yeah. So Lauren is pretty into like Day of the Dead and skeletons and stuff, which I was never super into, but I quite like it actually. And we have these neighbors across the street that are like really into it. Like they throw a Day of the Dead party every year.
Cool.
And so I would agree with that. It's like, you're looking at this skeleton and like theoretically that skeleton should be scary, but it's not actually mm-hmm. because it's surrounded by all of this like whimsy and sugar.
Yeah. So Bree's mom is actually really into Halloween, and growing up, Bree's house was always like tricked out and her mom has basically bequeathed to us almost all of the Halloween decorations from their house growing up. So we have, I'll post some of these on Instagram, but we have like some really like gnarly old school classic Halloween decorations, just like all over the house. It's like, it's kind of cool. And then the kids get into that too, which is cool. So here's my other take on Halloween. Like they talk about how after the 1918 flu pandemic, there were like big societal changes, right? You know, you had like indoor plumbing come in, things like that. I think our generation's indoor plumbing is the Halloween candy shoot from porch to street.
You're going to have to elaborate a little bit more.
So we've got neighbors, and I've seen this in other.
I mean, I know what a Halloween shoot is, but I'm wondering what the connection is, like you're making that.
So last year you needed the Halloween shoot in order to safely get beer, candy, whatever it may be, from porch level to street level, right?
We were not in the place where we were ready. Was there a beer shoot?
So my neighbors have a beer and candy system in place. It's more of a pulley kind of system than a shoot, but it's wonderful. So last year, like, you needed to do it. This year, there's no need to do it. Trick-or-treating was totally safe. Fauci said we could, but still a proliferation of candy shoots. And I think they're here to stay because they're just wonderful.
I think they're pretty awesome. Yeah, my neighbor across the street had one. And she learned pretty quickly that the angle was not steep enough. So if she put the like bag of M&Ms first, it would get stuck. Mm-hmm. So there became a science that developed. And I think that, you know, as indoor plumbing got more sophisticated, so too shall
candy you need some sort of like time. Hydraulic pump. Anyway, so our generation's indoor plumbing is the candy shoot.
I'm glad we're prioritizing the important things.
Yeah. So I am drinking a beer tonight, and said beer is from Aslan Beer Company out of Alexandria.
Love that beer company.
We've had a number of their beers on. This is the Palace Bohemian Pilsner. And it's like, it's light, yet it's complex, right? It's like a really intricate lace dress on a nice spring breezy day. That's what I'm drinking here.
And the Aslan Beer Company always has the best cans.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a guy at the beer store the other day, and I made that same comment. I was like, their cans are so cool. I love every one of them. And he was like, yeah, except they're all such like unique artistic designs. There's nothing about them that says this is from Aslan Beer Company. Like they almost dilute their brand in the creativity of the cans.
Oh, like there's no connection between like the one you're holding and the baby shark one in terms of like, oh, interesting. I mean,
and I said, well, I'm going to buy it anyway and give them some free advertising on my podcast. So
yeah. And I'm going to buy it at Whole Foods, which means I'm going to pay twice the price.
So we're helping Aslan Beer Company and Jeff Bezos.
And Jeff Bezos, who doesn't need any of our help and yet still gets a line item in my freaking budget. So I'm rocking a Solace Brewing Company, which is another favorite here.
Another staple.
Yeah, I mean, it was, this is the partly cloudy India Pale Ale. And this one, I'm going to try to rock like a mic introduction here of like what I'm drinking. So this one really tastes like whatever was in the back of my refrigerator. And it felt like it was appropriate to go down my throat on a Tuesday. And in that way, it's perfect.
In the back of your refrigerator, like the baking soda of beers.
Yes, absolutely. It's there. Who knows how long it's been there? Who cares? It's beer.
Beautiful. Should we jump into the first round?
Yeah, I mean, I'm way into the first round, but yes.
All right. It's not a stretch to say that the next 3 weeks hold huge leverage over the fate of humanity and modern civilization. COP26, the global climate summit, is risking basically not making a dent in the problem. The US is trying to lead that and the G20 while we sort of just came back to the table. And a whole party in our country wants to do less than nothing to keep our planet able to sustain its human population. Meanwhile, the US is also the largest oil producer in the world, and we're simultaneously pressuring the other oil producers to increase production. And the president's not just climate agenda, but literally his entire agenda is being held up by one person in Joe Manchin, who took in $400,000 from fossil fuel companies last quarter, 3 years before he's up for re-election. And really beyond the campaign finance implications, he founded a coal brokerage that has paid him $5.2 million in income since he joined the Senate, and in which he still retains an ownership stake worth up to $5 million as the company is being run by his son. Joe Manchin is rich, but like not that rich. He had a $7.6 million net worth as of 2018. I've seen estimates of $5 million today. And don't get me wrong, that's quite rich.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
But not so rich that a $5 million stake in this company is an afterthought to him. And like basically, so this company, EnerSystems, it is the big bet he made earlier in life that has set up everything else for him.
Mm.
Right. It continues to be his primary source of both income and wealth through the income he gets from it and his ownership stake, as well as his extended family's financial security, like for the foreseeable future. So what we have here is not really a campaign finance issue. It's a corruption issue. The principal in this situation has a glaring conflict of interest that is like legally totally above board, but is also going to potentially destroy human life on Earth.
So there's a couple of things there that you brought up. I mean, strong opening, first of all, like strong. Yeah, you're obviously past the first round yourself. And you brought up COP26, which I think we'll talk a little bit about this week. And I think we'll delve into a little bit more, which is it's the global climate summit, basically, that is supposed to happen every year. It didn't happen last year, but it's supposed to happen every year.
Yeah, we sort of skipped over context and went straight to rant tonight.
Yeah, which is cool. And the reason it's big this year is because it's the fifth year, well, sixth year, because, you know, after the Paris Agreement. So everybody knows what the Paris Agreement is. People don't necessarily know that the Paris Agreement was actually signed at COP21, which was 21 years after the 1992 first agreement in Rio that sort of like, oh, climate change is a thing. We should all do something about it. That was 1992 Rio. Fast forward 21 years, you have Paris. Fast forward another 5 or 6 years, you have now. So it's like a useful point for people to like check in on. And so here on News and Brews, we'll be checking in on it like over the next 2 weeks because it's supposed to last 12 days. So there's like that going on. But I think you tying it to the infrastructure bill is actually really useful and makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you look at the United States, it's like we can traipse around the world and be global leaders and talk about all the like texts that should be in the communiques. But, you know, at some point we need to put our money where our mouth is and we need to like enact domestic legislation that backs up some of what we're saying on the international stage. And you mentioned like we're an oil producing nation and we're trying to convince other oil producing nations to be less shitty or whatever.
No, we're trying to get them to produce more oil.
Oh, that's not what you were saying.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That's the problem. Is while COP is going on, we are also pressuring other oil producing nations to produce more oil.
So that we can drop the price of oil.
So that we can try to head off this inflation and increase the energy supply. And yes.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, like
which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, in that, you know, ideally you would have these world leaders going into COP26 with a limited other agenda or limited other urgent issues on their plate. And that's just not the situation we find ourselves in. And the fact that you have this economic crisis and this energy crisis happening around the world while COP is going on creates these contradictions, notably for the US, but not just for the US by any means.
Yeah, totally. And so I was actually interviewed by someone by a TV outlet earlier this week about COP. And this is a point that I made too, which is like, you can't talk about like US involvement in COP unless you also include the Build Back Better Act and sort of the infrastructure stuff that's going on here, because it, if passed, the infrastructure stuff, the two bills, one by regular order, one by reconciliation, if that stuff passes, it would be the most significant climate legislation in decades here in the United States, and would really send a strong signal that like we're serious about, you know, transitioning to net zero emissions by 2030 or whenever it is. So I think you combining those is really smart. I think the Joe Manchin rant is certainly not getting attention. I think that sort of conflict of interest point that you're bringing up is like, it's easy to just quote him. You know, when he talks about this, he doesn't say like, no, we shouldn't do this because it will harm my coal interests. Mm-hmm. Like he's like, I'm worried about inflation and I'm worried about like rising prices for West Virginians and things like that. And so, and his new thing today is like, I want to see how much, like, I want to see what the economic cost of this is, as if,
right,
you know, someone has an economic crystal ball or something.
Well, he's presumably looking for the CBO report.
Is that what he said though?
I think that's what's understood.
I thought the CBO came out with something on this.
Not on this latest bill. Not since they announced this $1.75 trillion version.
Okay, so they scored the $1 trillion thing, but they didn't score the reconciliation one.
I think that's right.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that I hate to, again, talk about infrastructure on News and Brews. It seems to be infrastructure week every week, but like he is the one who is now holding this up. It seems like, as we had suspected, Nancy Pelosi has sort of gotten her crew on board, and like, you know, the Priya Jayapals and others are like, you know, begrudgingly or not, going to support these dual efforts. But like, it seems like he is the primary holdout here, which is just really phenomenal.
Yeah. And, you know, the response to his press conference on, I think it was Monday of this week, from Democrats has been generally pretty sanguine, like not freaking out. The Biden administration has expressed confidence that they'll be able to pass it still. Even, you know, Pramila Jayapal in the House, leader of the House Progressive Caucus, declined to, you know, take any shots at Manchin and basically just said, you know, we're on board and we're going to, you know, kick this over to the Senate and hope that Joe Biden can deliver what he's promised and get 51 votes.
Which means that they're close. I think if they were, and certainly they're closer than when we had talked about this a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, when we talked about the perfect storm, it was like, how the hell is this going to come together? Well, it's coming together certainly closer. And that's the signal that I'm looking for, is like, are people coming out in opposition, even when Joe Manchin says ridiculous things? Like, no, because there's probably not too much distance between Joe Manchin and like where he is and where they need him to be. So hope springs eternal, but we're not ready to claim victory yet.
The other thing that I think is worth mentioning about the latest version of the reconciliation bill. So this has now basically been cut in half, right? The original investment was $3.5 trillion. We're now at $1.75 as the sort of final number. However, the things that got cut were not climate investments. So
yeah,
all of the climate investment from the $3.5 trillion full reconciliation bill has remained not quite intact, because you did have Joe Manchin cancel the clean energy standard that would have placed penalties on companies that emit high amounts of carbon, such as Enter Systems, the Joe Manchin founded coal company. They're actually a brokerage, so I don't know if they'd be directly affected, but their industry certainly would. That being said, they took the investment that would have been tied to that clean energy standard and just put it into other climate actions and other climate investments in the bill. You see, a friend of the show, Aileen Nowlin, tweeted, you know, that when they announced this bill at the end of last week, that, you know, it was basically just as she read the final provisions, sort of was just more and more impressed. So
yeah, it's big. I think we're close. I think I feel pretty good about this one. I mean, they took out paid family leave, which was like, my Twitter was going crazy that. And it was kind
don't
of like,
wrong.
Why?
They took out a bunch of important stuff.
Yeah.
That being said, And they also limited the timeline on a lot of other stuff. So like the child tax credit that has halved child poverty in the US this year, as it came into enactment, is now only extended for 1 year.
Yeah, as opposed to
instead
permanent.
Of being made permanent. So that's, you know, it's a big deal. Paid family leave is a big deal. I sort of personally like the strategy of cutting things out rather than like limiting the timeline dramatically. Mm. just because I feel like it sort of gives you another bite at the apple. There may be some issues where you can pick off a few Republicans here and there and actually get something done. Yeah, I think it was a mix of what ended up in the bill. I did see that they are also rolling back the cap on the state and local tax deduction that the Trump tax cuts put in place. And that in practice has brought on some of the quote unquote moderates in the House, like Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey, who were resistant to the package otherwise, but who with that rollback of the tax are now on board.
Yeah, I mean, it's all politics. They need to feel, and this is maybe what's happening with Joe Manchin, right? Like he needs to feel like he's getting something, and he needs to feel like he has exacted the political price and like, you know, fought for West Virginians, et cetera. And, you know, maybe that's what's happening. So moving on from COP, again, we'll talk a lot more about COP26. And as you sort of alluded to in your intro, I think it's one of the more significant things to happen on our planet. And we'll talk more at the end of this episode about G20. That's called foreshadowing. The G20 summit that happened in Rome. And also really important, like there's important things happening in Summitry. We do love some good Summitry here on News and Brews. Mm-hmm. But Mike, with your permission, I thought we might do a News and Brews first and actually like open up the New York Times and see what is happening in the Virginia governor's race. So like, it's going to be super awkward because people are going to listen to this on Wednesday and we'll probably already know the winner, but maybe they'll enjoy just like the horse race of us talking about it. Cause I think like by the time we're ending up with the episode, we could know who won.
Permission granted to you on a very limited basis, because this is going to give me a lot of heartburn.
Really?
I'm worried about this one. So I'll give a little bit of thoughts on where we are. Like I said, the next few weeks between the COP summit, the agenda of Democrats in Congress is just like existentially important, not just because of the environmental issue, but because if Democrats don't get something done, the midterm elections will be disastrous. And in all likelihood, the 2024 election will be disastrous. And, you know, probably the likeliest scenario at that point is that we get President Trump again. And if that happens, I don't know if we can really quite come back from that. And there's a corollary on the world stage where Joe Biden is making the argument that multilateralism, leaning into alliances, collective action is a better way than going it alone. And if we can't get results from this approach, either in Congress or on the world stage, I worry about what the reaction to that is. I worry a lot.
Yeah. I mean, our partners on the international stage are enjoying this moment where Joe Biden is, I mean, Putin and Xi are not enjoying this moment, but like, you know, our allies are enjoying this moment where like Washington's back, you know, we like multilateralism again. But there's a lot of hesitation and skepticism, I think, for the reasons that you're talking about. And they're probably also watching the results of the Virginia governor's race to see,
is
this a signal?
These off-cycle races tend to be bellwethers. And, you know, you saw it in 2009 with Bob McDonnell getting elected after Obama came in. I mean, you even saw it with Ralph Northam getting elected in 2017 after Trump going the other direction. And, you know, we sort of averted disaster in California where it was looking for a while, like Gavin Newsom might lose that recall. Fortunately, that didn't happen, but we're sort of facing a similar dynamic here where Biden won Virginia by 10 points. And if it's McAuliffe's not able to win, it just sends a very worrying sign through all of politics in our country. And I think probably makes it a little bit less likely that these bills actually pass Congress.
Yeah, like it emboldens people who, you know, think that there is a coming wave in the other direction, perhaps. So, okay, it's 9 p.m. and McAuliffe's down by 11 points, 64% reporting. I think what should give you a little bit of solace is that Fairfax County is only 32% reported. but there's certainly, this is not a particularly good race so far, it seems. It seems like he's underperforming what he did in the last time he ran for governor. But we will maybe check back in, or if it's too upsetting for Mike, maybe we won't. So let's move on.
Let's move on to something less upsetting. Facebook.
Facebook.
Facebook changed its name to Meta, reflecting a new strategic focus and massive investment in the metaverse, a virtual space for gaming, productivity, and other functions people can access through the company's Oculus headsets. People have been dunking on this move for a variety of reasons, right? Straight up just not liking Facebook. The awkward rollout where Mark Zuckerberg had a bottle of barbecue sauce as a bookend on an otherwise sterile office Zoom background.
Did you also see, like, he simulated the metaverse? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, again, I'm looking forward to this segment, honestly, Mike, because I don't know how to react to any of this, and I'm hoping that you will explain it to me. But like, so, that was weird as shit.
It was very uncanny valley, right? Like Zuckerberg came off as less of a CEO and more of like a buggy AI in that.
Yeah, video. It was weird.
And overall, like, I think the name change just has a bit of a feel of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Death Star.
Oh, I see what you did there. It's not the Titanic. They're not sinking. It's the Death Star. They're going to destroy everything.
Right.
I caught the movie reference.
Nice one. At the same time, though, like, has any organization ever been in more need of a name change? A rebrand?
It's a fair point. It's a fair point.
The answer is yes. It happened once. In 1985, the Houston Astros had a minor league affiliate also named the Astros. They moved that minor league Astros team to Kissimmee, Florida.
So what was their name?
So they couldn't call them the Kissimmee Astros, and they had to call them the Cobras. And I think that's the only
time. Is this a true story?
This is true, yes. I think that's the only time there's been a worse name than Facebook in this moment.
I mean, there's lots of bad names, right? Like the Washington Redskins. That's a hilarious story. I did not know that.
Here's the thing about the metaverse. Had you ever heard this term before Facebook started like making noises about it a few weeks ago?
I still don't know what the hell it means.
Yeah. So it comes from a 1992 sci-fi novel by Neal Stephenson called Snow Crash. In Snow Crash, the future United States has basically become one giant strip mall.
Okay.
Like the government has ceded most of its power and functions to large corporations. It's like an anarcho-capitalist hellscape.
Okay.
The metaverse.
Are there blockbusters in the strip mall?
Presumably. The metaverse, and like, you know, like Hong Kong has been taken over by like a chain of Chinese restaurants or something. Like it's like, you know, really like
sort of. Or just taken over by China. You know, hellscape.
The metaverse has become an escape from that world, but it almost instantly begins to mirror the inequities and injustices of this hyper-capitalist dystopia.
This is like Ready Player One.
Similar. I mean, Ready Player One is like another kind of like early metaverse concept, right? I came into this whole metaverse change actually like somewhat hopeful. You know, like it would make our conversations a lot of fun. Like we do them over Zoom right now. My company, First 90, is fully remote. Like it would be awesome to have like a virtual space that was a little bit more high touch or sensory than like a Zoom conversation.
I don't even know what that means though. Like, do I put on a headset and then like touch a wall?
The Oculus headset is also like a pretty good product from what I've heard. I don't have one.
So you're supposed to put on the Oculus by Facebook headset and you're supposed to be transformed, but like you were talking about like touch and stuff. Like what do you,
so touch is not part of it at this point. And like that is a limitation, right? Like we're not just visual creatures, humans, and I don't think they quite have a solution, but I mean, you could see them coming up with one. Anyway, I have some hope about this, particularly if it's like a business use case that lends itself much more to a subscription model than an advertising model. But really until they change their core business model, you know, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time, like between everything Facebook has done over the last, call it, 5 or 6 years, and this like weird metaverse dystopia anarcho-capitalist callback. I think my hope is waning pretty quickly. Anyway, congrats to Mark Zuckerberg for no longer being the CEO of Facebook. That seems like a pretty shitty gig.
Are we not supposed to call it Facebook anymore?
Well, so Facebook is still like the core product and platform. The parent company is Meta.
Okay, so it's like Alphabet and Google.
Yes.
Okay. Best of luck or something. Yeah. I still don't understand what the hell it is.
Moving on. We didn't cover this story last week, but it's not often that I get a news alert that makes me do like a literal double take. And seeing Alec Baldwin has shot multiple people on the set of his own movie, Killing One, was one of those alerts.
Yeah, I totally agree. I thought it was like an Onion thing. And then I was like, this is not an Onion. This is tragic. Like, holy shit. I can't stop reading this.
Yeah. So to recap the basics, Alec Baldwin was producing, funding, and playing an outlaw in an independent Western movie called Rust. He was rehearsing a scene that required him to draw his pistol, and he was handed a gun that the prop guy told him was cold, meaning it had been checked and confirmed to have no ammo in it. When he drew the gun, it fired an actual bullet, wounding the film's director, Joel Souza, and killing its cinematographer, Helena Hutchins. And so, as you said, this is like, first and foremost, a tragedy. Hutchins was born in Ukraine. She was the daughter of a sailor in the Soviet Navy. She made her way to LA, got an education, was living the actual American dream, had a young son. Absolutely tragic.
That's terrible.
That's not why I want to talk about this. I want to talk about the biggest open question, which is, how did live rounds or even a real gun get onto this set? Like, shouldn't they have props for that?
But also, okay, so I agree, and let's talk about that. But like, did he point the gun at the director and pull the trigger?
From what I understand, it was in the act of drawing. It was like a cross-body draw of the pistol. And it wasn't even that he was like pointing and shooting. He was like drawing it, and it went off.
Did he shoot multiple times or did one bullet?
It was one bullet that I think went basically like through the cinematographer and lodged in the director, and they recovered it from his body.
Whoa. Okay. So he's just like, yeah. Okay. All right. That makes sense.
So they don't know yet how this came to be. They said there was potentially other live ammo on set, which is like totally against the rules. In trying to figure this out, I came across an interesting story. Do you know the movie Lord of War with Nicolas Cage? It's okay if you don't.
I think you know the answer.
That was a rhetorical question. Listener, you know the movie Lord of War with Nicolas Cage? Of course you do. It also had like Jared Leto. It was great. It was 2005. You would actually really, I think, enjoy the movie, Errol. Ethan Hawke was in it too. Nick Cage plays an arms dealer who's been selling weapons to combatants on various sides of various conflicts over multiple decades.
Interesting. I like that you think I would like that.
So they needed like 3,000 Kalashnikov rifles for this movie. And they needed to get them in the Czech Republic. But they realized that it was much cheaper to buy real Kalashnikov rifles than the prop versions, because the real ones, they could just turn around and sell back.
Oh, I don't like that at all.
And and so that's what they did. And they rented real tanks too for the movie. And the guy who they got them from said, "You can use these, but I need them back by December because I'm selling them to Libya."
Oh.
And so this...
It was a simpler time.
Right. Still post 9/11. But so this kind of just raises a bunch of questions of like, why are guns on the set of this movie in the first place? Why is it okay?
Yeah, this wasn't in the Czech Republic. Like,
real guns like on a movie set at all. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And it's just, I think, you know, symptomatic of this like larger weird obsession and easy access we've created in the US and around the world to deadly weapons.
So interesting. So you're basically saying maybe it was easier for them to get access to real weapons than it was to get access to prop weapons.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about it hasn't come out, right? The news about what happened on the set of Rust.
It's a plausible theory. It's the United States of America. Yeah.
It has happened very recently on a much larger scale.
Interesting. Yeah. No, tragic story, but like so many questions. I'm glad you clarified the one, because I was like, it wasn't like he killed another actor during the scene. It was like did he get pissed off at the, or was he like acting with the director? Like, that's such a random thing.
So by all accounts, he's been like absolutely devastated over the
fact that this happens.
And like, as you would imagine. Yeah. And has been, you know, really proactive about reaching out to Helena Hutchins' family and trying to support in any way they can. There's still a lot of open questions about legal liability. He actually, Baldwin may face charges, I think, because he's a producer of the movie more than anyone.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so the buck stops with him in terms of like responsibility for like safety.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. Well, maybe we should just have less movies with guns. I don't know what the takeaway is from this.
Yeah, we don't know yet. Maybe we'll come back to it. Maybe we won't. Should we move on to our main story?
Yeah, let's do it. So we alluded to this before, but the main story this week is going to be the G20, which is short for the Group of 20. And this, so Mike, how much do you know about the G20?
I know that it stands for the Group of 20.
Did you know that the European is one of those countries, which is fun because the European Union is not a country?
Wait, the EU counts as one country in the G20?
Affirmative. Which is also fun because other like France and Germany are also countries that are involved. Oh. So there's a little bit of like double counting involved.
That's what they did at the G7 too, right? Where there were like 9 people at the G7.
Yeah. So both the G7 and the G20, like they invite other countries to like, you know, like Spain, for example, is not a G20 country, but they're like a permanent observer, which feels like a really shitty space to be if you were Spain. It's like, you're always going to be the little brother and you're always going to be second. Anyway, so this is the G20 is every year since 1999, the quote unquote world's major economies, which is like a direct quote from their website, they get together to talk about stuff. So what they talked about in 1999 was probably not a global pandemic and was probably not, you know, some other things that are going on right now. But, you know, every year, basically there's a rotating presidency for egalitarian reasons. So this year it happens to be Italy. The 20 is significant because, I mean, I was sort of joking about the world's major economies, but like legit, they're together. They make up 80% of the world's GDP. Mm. They make up 75% of global trade, and they're 60% of the population. So in case, you know, listeners are counting at home, yes, India and China are part of this, without which both the population and the trade and the GDP numbers probably wouldn't add up. So yes, India, China, the United States, et cetera. And so the presidency last year was Saudi Arabia. Next year, it's going to be Indonesia. But this year, it's Italy. Okay. So they get together. All these world leaders got together in Rome, except for Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and the leaders of Mexico and Japan, and which I'll come back to their absence in a little bit. But the funniest thing that I saw, Mike, out of this was there were these like memes going around where, have you been to Rome?
Yes.
So did you like stand in front of the Trevi Fountain and throw a coin over your shoulder?
Yeah, I studied in Rome.
Oh, no shit. Really? Mm-hmm. So did you do that multiple times? Like when people come visit you?
Every day. Just went down to the fountain, threw some money away.
So there were these great memes, like all these world leaders, you know, Sarkozy and Boris Johnson and Joe Biden, they're all standing in front of the Trevi Fountain, like throwing coins over. And there were these great memes about like the plan to solve climate change.
my favorite one. So the real caption on this photo was world leaders toss a coin into the Trevi Fountain for good luck fighting the climate emergency, yes. Which is a joke in and of itself, but someone,
it was like a real headline.
Someone quoted that and said, all the haters that thought we didn't have a plan sure look stupid now.
Yes. It's great. It's really, really great. So they were in Rome throwing coins into the Trevi Fountain and also talking about stuff. So just like take off the news and brews hat for a second, Mike. And like, if you were setting the agenda, what would you be talking about right now?
So here's what I'd be talking about. The World Series is a total dud.
So Atlanta's playing Houston, right?
Maybe. Yeah, that sounds right. But like, it's every game takes like 5 hours.
It's a problem.
Like, nobody can handle this.
So we don't know who's winning versus who's losing. By the way, Youngkin is still winning, 71% reported. Yeah, so you'd be talking about the World Series.
Yeah.
Just because it's called the World Series doesn't mean that other countries care about it. You realize that, right?
Oh, is that not true?
No.
Sorry, guess I don't know what world means.
World championships, and it's like only the US.
I think there's some debate over whether that was like classic American hubris calling our baseball championship the World Series, or it was named after like a paper that was called The World.
Oh, I would have difficulty believing it wasn't the former.
I'm pretty sure it's the former too.
Which of course our Japanese friends would beg to differ. The only country in the world where baseball is bigger than the US is obviously Japan. Okay, the answer to the question, you got it wrong. It was not the World Series. Mm. They on their agenda was essentially climate change, COVID, kind of economic difficulties, and taxes.
You know, that's probably better than mine.
Yeah, taxes was kind of like the one I wasn't expecting. It's like you expect, I mean, we've talked about supply chain issues, et cetera. So you expect that and the energy prices to fall in the economics bucket because, you know, look, if your countries collectively are 80% of the global economy, then theoretically you can do something about it, you know, these challenges. And then obviously COVID is, you know, continuing to be a challenge. And I think it was really nice of the organizers of the G20 and the Glasgow COP26 summits to like align the schedules such that people could go from Rome to Glasgow. And so they obviously, since that was happening and since COP26 is such a kind of major point to check in, it is not surprising that climate was top of the agenda as well. Mm-hmm. So on climate, there were some good things. The group of 20 leaders, including those who joined virtually, recommitted to Paris and sort of the commitments under Paris, which is, I feel like, the bare minimum, but still good. They pledged to target net zero carbon emissions, like set targets, basically, to get to net zero carbon emissions. Differing years, some very nebulous. I'll get to that in a minute. The most significant thing that I think happened is that they agreed, like all 20 countries agreed not to fund new coal-fired power plants starting in the end of this year. Now, caveat, they can fund coal power plants in their own countries. They're just not going to finance coal power plants outside of their countries, which developing countries might take issue with because in some places that's the only way that they get energy. And so like, yes, it's very dirty, but like the choice between electricity and energy and not, mm-hmm. you know, is sometimes coal because there's lack of kind of green energy alternatives, et cetera. So that's the good. The not so good is that like, other than that, by the end of this year, we're not going to fund coal stuff. To every commitment was assigned a super wishy-washy timetable.
Hmm. And none of it was binding, right?
None of this stuff is binding. Here's the rub is that like, I think these summits are very important. Don't get me wrong. I think it's really important for there to be like a little bit of collective action and like putting pressure on other countries. But like none of this happens unless there is like domestic legislation to back it up. That's the sort of not so good. The other not so good is that Xi and Putin both stayed home citing COVID. But like, honestly, like President Xi of China hasn't left China in like 600 days, which seems a little weird.
Yeah, does anybody know what's going on with that?
Like, is he still alive? Or is it just like...
He's making a lot of public appearances.
Yeah, but like deepfakes are a thing. So conspiracy, news and brews, I don't know.
Zuckerberg.
He's rolling in the metaverse.
So one bright spot on climate, and this wasn't directly from the G20, but was announced by the US and the EU in line with the G20. Another friend of the show, David Villagra, flagged this. So the US and EU over the weekend also agreed to the world's first carbon-based trade agreement. They haven't finalized an agreement. They basically will, you know, get everything in writing and finalized over the next 2 years. But this is specifically for the aluminum and steel industries. And so rather than setting tariffs like we have historically, which of course is based on the country's openness to building a Trump hotel, we will going forward set tariffs on aluminum and steel based on the carbon intensity of the end products. So how much carbon has gone into the life cycle of that product
in
its manufacture. And this is huge because together those industries, aluminum and steel alone, account for 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
Is that more or less than cow farts?
But this agreement is expected to totally remake these industries in a much greener image. And it's these spaces, these like stodgy industrial spaces that are both huge contributors to climate change and some of the hardest areas to green. So it's seen as a huge win in the environmental community. It's also kind of interesting from a geopolitical perspective or maybe an international trade perspective, where this is all an outcome of the trade war that started under the last administration that kind of started with China and really expanded to also, you know, covering trade between the US and the EU. And this puts an end to, you know, multiple WHO disputes, but it also in the short term does continue to penalize China because their products tend to be more carbon intense. So that obviously can change over time. It's not a direct target of them. They have all the flexibility to, you know, improve their processes and are expected to. But it's kind of interesting that you do have the US and EU taking this action that is objectively amazing from a climate perspective, but also a bit of a jab at China.
This is an interesting one because one of the hardest things coming out of Paris, so Paris realized that you needed to bring carbon trading and like basically climate markets, you know, you needed to bring the markets into this if you wanted sustainable change. And it's been one of the most difficult challenges for countries to solve. I mean, in this country, there's lots of reticence to carbon pricing and carbon trading. And, you know, there's one party is obviously more against it than the other, but there's, you know, lots of opposition to regulating carbon markets in a more significant way, which is essentially one of the things that Paris have called for. And so maybe this is a first step in that direction, right? Like if we can do aluminum and steel, maybe then it can kind of, you know, trickle out over to other kind of heavy emissions industries.
Yeah, probably not if we give Joe Manchin a veto over it.
Well, it's not going to be coal yet. Coal should be first. Let's be real. Okay, so moving on to COVID. The goal that people keep talking about is by the end of 2021, trying to get 40% of the global population vaccinated against COVID-19. And the goal further out is by the middle of next year to have 70% of the world. Now, we used to think of 70% as, you know, some sort of like enough or herd immunity or whatever it's what it is. And like people think that with the various variants out there, that may not actually be enough. But let's be real, by 70% by mid next year would actually be a pretty significant step on the road back. Of course, not going to be evenly distributed. Right? Like you've got Nordic countries that are in the 90%+. You've got sub-Saharan African countries that are in the single digits still. This is not going to be an evenly distributed thing. However, you know, and they did talk about that a little bit. They did talk about sort of increased levels of foreign aid to help bridge that gap. But, you know, I think nonetheless, I'm encouraged that they're still talking about COVID. There's a funny story here.
Yeah.
So Russia's pissed.
Why is that?
So you've heard of their vaccine. It's called the Sputnik V.
Yep.
And like, I feel like so much in Russia is like Putin getting his feelings hurt because someone's challenging his masculinity and like the lack of global recognition and sort of WHO recognition for the veracity of the Sputnik V vaccine. I feel like he's taking this personally. And so he actually brought this up. The Russians brought this up during the G20 and it resulted in this like really funny, like we will work together towards the recognition of so like wait, language.
Was Putin there at the G20?
No. No, he sent an emissary and I believe he may have like zoomed in for a session, but
he just sent like one guy to go whine about his vaccine.
So there's, yeah. And there's really funny photos of, like they all take this like soccer team photo, of world leaders. And there's like, you know, Macron and Joe Biden and all these like very kind of world recognizable individuals. And then there's like the second agricultural minister from Siberia or something. Like, I mean, I'm making that up, right? But it's some lower tier official from Russia and China were kind of sent to be emissaries. And like, it was sort of the geopolitical middle finger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to, like, they use COVID as the excuse, but it's hard to interpret that in any other way, if yep. you ask me.
Yeah.
Okay, couple more things. So the economy and taxes, which are obviously related, but the economy, they talked about some of the things that we've talked about on News and Brews. So News and Brews bump G20 edition, you know, the supply chain disruptions that we've talked about a lot, the energy prices that we've talked about, inflation. These were definitely talked about at the G20. And I don't know if you've seen anything, Mike, but I didn't see anything other than like, we got this, our economists are remaining vigilant.
I mean, what would you hope for? Like, I think when groups like this have met in times of acute economic crisis, like the 2008 financial crisis, you saw a commitment for central banks around the world to work together in fighting the crisis. Feels like that's not quite needed right now. Like the thing about inflation, and we've talked about this a bit in the past, is interest rates are still at such historically low levels. And the fight against inflation was so successful going back to like the 80s in the US and across most of the developed world that I think policymakers just feel like we have plenty of ammo in the tank to fight against inflation if and when it is clear that it's a problem. Now, that will have a take a toll on economic growth, and that's not our first choice of things we want to do, and we're not totally sure that inflation's here to stay, and certainly not the hyperinflation that you'd really be worried about. So there's a lot of ifs there. But I don't know exactly what you would hope for on the economy, except, you know, Biden leaning on other oil producers to try to get more energy out into the marketplace.
Well, that, but also one thing that was discussed, and they came up with this vague, like, we'll remain vigilant language as an alternative to actually doing something on it, is, you know, look, all these like G20 countries have done some variation of quantitative easing. It's manipulation of interest rates. It's, mm-hmm. you know, fiscal stimulus, et cetera. And there was like zero appetite to roll any of that back, even though theoretically, I'm again not an economist, but theoretically, some of that may be contributing to what we're seeing in some of the economic disruptions. And I think,
Or at least to roll it back in a coordinated way, right? So like the US has announced exactly. tapering, and I think the EU has said something similar, but they're not going to.
But they don't want to do it preemptively or like first, you know, and other countries swoop in, which actually leads me to the taxation thing, because one of the things that Joe Biden has been talking about a lot is this sort of, and Trump much less eloquent way, he was also talking about like unfairness to American workers. And so Joe Biden actually puts more accessible words around this, but it's essentially like, it's unfair that like US jobs are being shipped overseas to places that have lower tax rates, for mm-hmm. example. And so there has been this push by the Biden administration via the OECD, which is another club of rich nations. Don't ask me the difference between the OECD and the G20. I'm just kidding. There's OECD a big difference.
Let Spain in, right?
They did. And Colombia actually just joined OECD. But it's essentially like, OECD is countries that have received, you know, reached a certain level of economic development, and you're like a so-called rich country, whereas the G20 is 20 countries,
yep.
or 19 countries and a union. So the tax thing is the Biden administration via the OECD has been unhappy about how, you know, the Facebooks and the Amazons and the Googles of the world have been able to just go to places that have lower kind of corporate tax yeah. rates. And so this is like a not so subtle jab at all of that. And just being like, look, folks, like we're 80% of global GDP. Like, let's agree on a global minimum corporate tax rate, which they did, and it's 15%, and theoretically that should be in place by 2023.
And this is, it's a huge deal. This is, has been a major focus of Janet Yellen since she got into the Treasury Secretary role. The US was pushing this hard at the G7 and has been building from there. It's a big win both for kind of global fairness, but also just societal fairness and the domestic tax code. I think this same minimum tax is reflected in some legislation. I can't remember if it's one of the two bills that's before Congress right now or another one, but I think is expected to be enacted in the US domestically as well. You've got all these companies making billions and billions of dollars and paying zero taxes. And this is a big fix.
I mean, it's an interesting point you just made, because I wonder how much domestic appetite there will be for something like this, because the challenge for this $15 minimum tax on multinational corporations is that, okay, you can sign a thing at a meeting in Rome, but that's, like you mentioned earlier, Mike, like that's not going to be binding. You have to actually enact this stuff at a domestic level. And in the United States, that means like essentially signing a treaty, which astute listeners will know requires 2/3 of the Senate to sign on to it. And so like, is the 2/3 of the US Senate in 2021 or 2022 going to agree to anything? Maybe this, I mean, our corporate tax rates are 21% in the United States. So like theoretically it's sort of no skin off our back. And there's a fairly obvious case to be made from sort of like the Trumpy right to the Bernie left that this is protecting American workers. I'm a little skeptical that 2023 deadline is going to be able to pass here in the United States. But look, I think this stuff all starts at a meeting in Rome where people are throwing coins over their shoulders. Like this is how this starts. And it's, we're at least on the road to this, which I agree with you is a pretty significant road to be on.
All right. Well, Errol, I think we fixed it.
We fixed like taxes, COVID. yes, we fixed it. Mike, it was great to see you as always.
As always.
We'll see everyone next week.
Thanks, everyone. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabake. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, November 2nd, 2021 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.